Our commandment this morning is the seventh: you shall not commit adultery. So back in 2003, I was a senior in high school, and for Christmas that year, I remember my extended family always did a Christmas exchange where you got one person's name and you gave them a gift. And my aunt got my name, didn't know what to give a 17-year-old girl, and so she gave me a $100 gift card to Amazon, which was still, you know, sort of relatively new at the time. And I remember thinking to myself that I could barely imagine how to spend a whole $100 on Amazon, which feels positively quaint today when I look back. But because of the internet memory of my Amazon account, I can go back to that evening, December 28th, 2003, and I can review what high school Kelly purchased with her very first gift card. She bought several CDs by Elliott Smith and Nick Drake. She purchased a subscription to Rolling Stone magazine, copies of Zoolander and Ever After on DVD, and a couple of books by Elizabeth Wurtzel of Prozac Nation fame. Now, if those names mean anything to you, you have a really good picture of who I was as a senior in high school. High school Kelly really pictured herself sort of like a broody artist, like wearing all black, even though I never actually could bring myself to do that. I like to live vicariously through these dark indie artists and their like real hard world experiences. Now, you all may not be as weird as me on this particular point, but sometimes I do this. Sometimes I, because I'm procrastinating on a sermon or I'm bored and I'm on a computer, I will go back and I will review what I purchased on Amazon during a given year. And it's really fascinating to sort of scroll through my own personal history of consumption. What books was I intending to read at that point in time? What music was I listening to, or what baking ingredient did I need that was too obscure for me to get at the local grocery store? Now, when I go back and I look through these purchases, aside from more than like a little bit of chagrin at the large sum of money that I have spent on Amazon over the last 16 plus years, they are also these little snapshots of who I was, who I saw myself to be, who I wanted to be, and who I was becoming. And sort of my own personal, like, capitalism scrapbook of sorts. And I mention that because this week I was faced with the question of what would I do if I lost access to my Amazon account? I would lose that history for sure. I would also lose access to the many, many pieces of digital content that I've purchased, you know, like movies and TV shows and albums, things like that, that are only on Amazon. And if I didn't have my account, I couldn't get them anymore. But I would also lose access to all these little bits and pieces of information that lessen my mental load over the span of weeks and months. Things like, I don't remember what brand of special senior dog glucosamine treats my dog gets because Amazon charges me and sends them to me once every 2 months, so I never run out and I get exactly what I need. The same with my favorite brand of tea. It comes in the mail on approximately the right schedule when I am about to run out of it at home. What cleaning product did I really like using that one time? I can go and I can look that up. And that may not sound like a lot to some of you, but I think any of you out there who are the household purchasers for your home probably understand that if you're able to offload some of that information somewhere else so it doesn't take up space in your brain, that actually does make mundane everyday tasks a little bit easier. And I was thinking about that because I got a call from a friend of mine who's going through exactly this problem right now, losing her Amazon account. She's going through a rather nasty divorce, and part of disentangling their family life of over a decade includes the fact that she no longer has access to what was her Amazon account for more than 10 years of her life, and all of the data that that account contained. She rightly described it to me as sort of one of those mundane, bureaucratic pieces of minutia that comes with divorce that she called the 1,000 tiny indignities of separating your life from the life of someone else. Now, there are, of course, the biggies that you would expect. There are bank accounts and the mortgage and child custody and all of those. But the more I talk with her, the more that I'm surprised by these tiny little things I never would have considered. The Amazon account, the who picks up the kid from school question, who the school calls first. Some of you, I know, can speak to this with far more eloquence and personal experience. My role in this has simply been as a friend and a sounding board, and my perspective has sort of natural blinders and limits. It only serves me so much. But what struck me about our conversation was that this loss of an Amazon account felt like an absurd ripple from her divorce. We know when we drop a stone in a pond, we know what like the general effect is going to be. We know that when you decide to separate your family, there are going to be consequences. You're dropping a stone into water. There will be ripples. But we can't predict how many ripples there's going to be. We can't predict the interference patterns as they bounce off around the irregular edges of the lake. We don't know what's going to happen, the final effect of that turbulence, even if we know that the start is predictable. Now, I've preached on divorce before. We've talked about how divorce is not quite the big, scary evil that sometimes Christian pastors and churches have made it out to be. Sometimes divorce is right and good. It's a part of God loving us where we find ourselves in particular moments of our life. Sometimes it's the healthiest decision for everyone involved. And so we could go back and revisit that, but that's not the intent of my sermon today. And if you're curious about that, I'll print out a sermon or sit down and chat with you about it. But divorce is sort of the natural corollary. It's the natural consequence of the commandment that we're talking about today, which is adultery, or I think probably more accurately, a commandment of fidelity. Now, the commandments, as I mentioned a few weeks ago, kind of come in two tablets, serving God and serving one another. And we are deep into loving our neighbors, the second half of the commandments. We started that by looking at our very closest neighbor, our first neighbor, our parents and our elders, those who brought us into the world, those who raised us and gave us life. And what do we owe our closest neighbor? Last week, we talked about you shall not murder or you shall protect life, which at its deepest core is a commandment about ourselves and our own souls, respecting and protecting life in order to keep ourselves whole individuals. It is concerned with others, but it's also concerned with ourselves. This commandment sort of moves one rung out. What do we do with those neighbors who are closest to us by choice? Our families of choice that we choose to be in ongoing relationship with. And of course, families, and especially marriage relationships, can look really different across the board. Now, when these commandments were written, and very often when this one's preached on, we focus exclusively on marriage. But I'd actually like to sort of broaden that picture a little bit and instead use the term family of choice, those people that we choose to be in close relationship with. That can, of course, look very like Norman Rockwell, right? Mom and dad and 2.5 kids and the dog and the nice dining room table and all of that. But a family of choice might also be a single parent with 3 kids, or it might be a widower and his son and their pet snake who lives in the house with them, or it might be 2 women who live together in a committed relationship and choose not to have children, or it might be a house full of single people who for an extended period of time have claimed one another as their family of choice. Families look dramatically different from one another. On the outside, John and my family often looks quite quintessential, right? Like 2 parents, 3 kids, we have a dog, a nice little flock of chickens that you're all welcome to come over and meet anytime you'd like. But our family flexes from time to time with friends and interlopers who need to be a part of a family for a period of time. We've had people who literally live in our house alongside us, who eat at our table and become part of the mundane family rhythms that we live, sometimes for months or very extended periods of time. They become a part of our family of choice. And whether our families are constructed by marriage or happenstance, promise or common law, whatever brings us together, this is a commandment that speaks to one another, our closest circle of neighbors. Now, when I went back and did my research this week on this commandment, John Calvin and Martin Luther and Augustine and all the other good straight-laced church fathers were a little bit disappointing to me. They were quite hand-wringy about this commandment and about chastity and modesty and whether it was better to remain unmarried than become liable to breaking up a marriage and dealing with this particular commandment. To a single person, blamed women more than men, because adultery is clearly the fault of women. Men would be just fine if there weren't these sort of tardy ladies running around with their wily ways, was the impression that I got from most of their commentary. But honestly, my deepest disappointment with them was just that they were so narrowly focused on marriage and on the literal act of adultery that I think that they missed the forest for the trees. And of course, this is a commandment about marriage. I'm not saying it doesn't include that. But more importantly, this is a commandment about the faithfulness and the fidelity with which we follow through on the promises that we make to one another. When we do what we've been doing over the past few weeks and take this commandment and flip it inside out, it looks very different. It's not merely a prohibition against acts which violate our promises to one another. Instead, when we turn it inside out, this is a commandment that nudges us toward integrity in our actions. This is a commandment that is sort of interesting because it actually has two different forces to it, the internal and the external. And so I'm going to try to describe these. Stick with me for just a second. So first of all, this commandment has an internal force, which is how we most often think about it. And the internal force asks that we take the vows that we make to our family most seriously. So in my particular case, those are the vows that I literally made publicly and out loud in front of 400 people to John when we got married. But those are also the unspoken vows and promises that hold together my relationship with my children and my parents, my younger sister, my grandmother, and a few of my very closest aunts and uncles who really are part of that sort of inner family of choice, my closest people. And those vows, this commandment says, internally, I have a requirement to be faithful to what those promises say, the spoken and the unspoken. And to be there when, you know, my kid had a really hard day at school, and they come home, and what they need from me is to be a little bit gentler and more flexible than the people that they interacted with during the day. It means that for my grandma, I'm going to show up for her when she needs someone to be present with her because she's going through a rough evening. For my aunt, it means that when she's out of town and needs someone to show up for my grandma, if there is an emergency, I follow through on that for my aunt. I am trustworthy. I am a person of my word. I, to the best of my ability, keep those promises to my closest circle of neighbors. But the other way we should view this commandment is the external force of it, right? And this is, I think, what might be a little new in how we think about it. We could take this story of adultery, because it's literally what this commandment is talking about, and it's a pretty good example, right? So adultery, as the saying goes, it takes two to tango, right? So it is not merely, as Calvin and Luther might want us to think, all the fault of women. It is the fault of two people who are interacting in a way that is inappropriate to the vows that they have each made to those to whom they love. But it's not just a violation of me to my own marriage vows or to the other person to their marriage vows. There's also a violation between the two people that if I am involved in that, I am causing someone else to break a vow, and they are causing me to break a vow as well. So when we choose to follow this commandment, to be people of integrity who follow through on our own promises, part of what that does is externally it encourages and enforces those vows and those promises for other people and their family circles as well. By protecting my own vows, I am honoring my neighbor and protecting theirs as well, the internal and the external force of this commandment. And of course, this is not just literal adultery. Like, I hope you're hearing that in the way that I'm talking about this. There are 1,000 ways, big and small, that we can violate the promises of another person, that we can violate the promises we make ourselves without ever touching another human being. And we all know that. Because there is little in our lives that is quite as vulnerable as placing our trust in other people to the point that we allow our lives to become woven together. And a violation of trust in those relationships does damage to other people, and it wounds our own integrity. It's like cutting a piece of fabric, right? The ends can get frayed because you're losing the integrity of that weaving, holding it together. You violate that trust when you break those vows and promises, and it is like the stone that drops into the pond. You know exactly what you're doing when you drop that stone, but you have no idea what the consequences of that action might actually look like. Who might be hurt or heartbroken along the way, or how long it might take that smooth surface to come back to normal if it ever does. And I think this is why the commandment states in no uncertain terms that we are to be people of integrity, that we should honor the vows that we have made to our families of choice and our families of biology, and that we should do our best to help others honor those vows as well, that we should take seriously the vulnerability of others who are bound up in our life and to honor the gift of their commitment to us. Because our lives, especially in those families, are woven together in 1,000 ways that we don't even see, from our Amazon accounts to our bank accounts. And those threads are painful to cut, but they are wildly supportive when we invest in making sure that they hold fast. Amen. I would invite you all to stand and join me in singing our next hymn, Love Divine, All Loves Excelling.